Welcome to Unpacked, an open-minded podcast taking a clinical, not political approach to helping pet parents around the world. I'm Sailor Jerry, certified dog trainer, virtual dog training revolutionary, owner of Tulsa Pack Athletics, and creator of the Open-Minded Approach.
And I'm Madison, her friend, certified dog trainer, and behavior consultant. Together, we have nearly three decades of experience in behavioral dog training.
We've been working with real dogs and the humans who love them to create solutions to problematic behaviors that feel too big for them to tackle on their own. In this episode, we are fully unpacking a new case, diving deep into a behavioral topic that you, our listeners, asked for.
If you're along for the ride, here's how it's going to look. First, we'll introduce the incredible and dedicated humans we've been working with and explain their intake process while we describe their dog or dogs and the behaviors they're experiencing.
Then we'll walk you through our assessment and explain how we got there.
Lastly, we'll break down the management and modification plan.
If you're ready to dive into this unique case, settle in with us and unpack.
Okay, Jerry. I am excited to finally get to talk about Julie and John and the beloved Scott.
So excited that we could barely get through this intro. We couldn't decide how to say it. There was talk of glitters.
So excited. Oh, glitters, the obvious choice. The obvious comparison.
It is. It's the obvious comparison. Glitter for Scott, glitter for Julia and John, just all around. And I think the reason is because Scott is very special. He was in some kind of accident or had some kind of traumatic injury that made his life a little bit different than other dogs. But we're here to tell you that Scott is a perfect example of how dogs have no self-pity. Mm-hmm. They have incredible will to live. And so I hope everybody listens into this episode because it's inspiring and also very educational.
And we hope that you come back for the next episode where you actually get to hear us talking to Julia and John. And I think really a humbling moment for me where I had just maybe thought that they were unicorns, right? And they reminded me that they aren't unique and that there's lots of people out there who have welcomed dogs with some type of physical limitation into their life. And, you know, that's a responsibility that they are happy to have. And what we got to talk about with them specifically were what types of accommodations can we make to training plans in order to make it accessible for Scott?
I did know about all of the special dog parents out there that are accepting animals into their home and loving them that have some kind of special need or limitation. But I've never been on the side of talking about their emotions and, you know, how they're living and transitioning from the day-to-day moments. So this was really, really interesting and special to me.
And I was really excited to get to be a part of this because it wasn't something I felt like I got to experience before. So I think, Jerry, the best place to start would be for you to explain a little bit about the specifics of Scott's injuries.
Information that we have about Scott's injuries are that he was dropped off at the Orange County Humane Society. That's in North Carolina in Chapel Hill. In 2021, under the name of Milo, my little boy's name is Milo, by his previous owner who stated that his legs had, and this is a quote, been weak since birth, end quote. So they did some x-rays on intake and there was a break in his thoracic spine. And for people that don't know, your cervical spine, that's the part that's up by your neck, your thoracic spine, that's just the things you would commonly hear people say. And then right underneath that is the area of your thoracic spine. And that's like basically your chest area all the way down to, you know, your abdomen. If you think about that in a person, okay. So you could kind of tilt that and think that that's what it is for a dog too, in general terms. I'm not a veterinarian. I'm just trying to help the listener understand what part of the spine we're talking about.
For me, you know, I come to you for physical and medical questions all the time because that is something that you have, you know, a couple years, 18 years experience.
Yes, yeah, some decent knowledge.
Yeah.
So they see that there is this break. And the doctor at the time, the veterinarian at the time thought, okay, this is about 2 weeks old. It's healed a little bit. And so Hope Animal Rescue pulled him out of the shelter, renamed him Shade because he was throwing a shade with his face.
Even the same guy.
Yeah.
immediately bring in the sass.
From the time that he was pulled into rescue, from the time that they adopted him, was really just about 2 months. So whatever healing took place in that time allowed him to be able to find a home. And that's how he ended up with Julia and John. And oh my gosh, dog, he landed in a great, great home.
It's true. It's the way that they talk about him. Like, that's what it is for me. It's not the fact that they care for him. Like, that's what you expect. It's the way that they talk about caring for him, that they feel honored and blessed to be able to be a part of his life and to be able to steward over him in that way. It was really touching.
What was most touching to me about it is, and I get on to people all the time about savior complex. It's this weird Western thing that people do. And it's sewn into our culture. And so we all do it, I think, without knowing we're doing it. But that's not what they're doing. They were talking about it. There was almost like this.
It's like he already has a light that's shining and they just wanted to help everyone see it. Like, they're just kind of there to, like, be. It's the same way that you talk about Enzo.
They're trying to help him reach the potential that he has, that he's capable of with what he's got. They're trying to help him get there. And I think
he's their best friend.
We can all learn from that. Like, if that's your best friend, and you go to all the links for them so that they can
help them being who they are and who they want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really
cool. He's such a cool dude. He's just this sassy, smart shepherd, and goodness, he's just so able. And I'm so excited to see where we can kind of take this with some of the, you know, sensitivities that we're trying to help them work through. But let's continue talking a little bit about the medical, because I know there is a little bit more to talk about in relation to in-depth grooming and physical care processes. So how did his injury affect sort of his more involved bathroom process? Like, how, if you could just help me understand maybe how that damage, you know, impacted his bladder and his colon and things like that.
His parents have explained it as quasi incontinence. So let's just talk about incontinence really quick. What incontinence is: the inability to control your bowels or your bladder. And those are controlled by sphincters. We have them in our stomach, in our bladder, in our bowels. We've got them different places in our body. And that system is controlled by our hormonal system. So just a general...
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... It's just kind of a general... So when...
That's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there, yeah. So...
A lot of systems.
Some dogs will have incontinence because there's something going on hormonally and there's nothing else wrong with them, but they can't hold their bladder. So there's different meds that they have supplemented, and then they aren't incontinent anymore, but they have to take those for the rest of their life. There's different things that can cause that. Some dogs have a traumatic injury and they lose feeling, and that's why they can't control those sphincters anymore. There are some dogs that will have that kind of traumatic injury and they have some feeling to the extent that they can hold it in, but they can't go on their own. And this is what's saying. So what they've explained is that he's not leaving little turds all over the house every day. He'll have a bowel movement, just like a help expressing that bowel movement. So it will all come out. He'll have his poop, you know, and then he goes about his day. And then there's, you know, some dogs that's not what they're experiencing, and they have incontinence all the time and they have to wear diapers or something like that. So it just depends on what their traumatic injury was and how the recovery, really not what the injury was. Really, it's more, I think, what the recovery is like.
And do you think it was my assumption, but, you know, his young age at the time of that injury has a big impact on that?
What do you mean? Do you mean on the way he was able to recover, or?
Yeah. Or maybe on the, on the ability to recover with him being young. Does that make it more likely to rebound? Does it impact the recovery at all?
I think the dogs have I think dogs have a really strong will to live. And so if they have an injury that's debilitating, but that doesn't kill them, they will learn to survive with that injury, period. They don't have the, just have a knowledge that they need to continue to live and seek resources that help them stay alive.
Really good point.
That's when now, part of their brain is bigger than ours. Mm-hmm. The part of their brain that
the survival instinct,
the seek for willpower. Yeah, it's larger than ours is.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the only real, I don't know, I guess, asks from John and Julia, maybe related specifically around the injury, was they just identified that there are ways in which it's easier to read a dog that does have full body movement. And they had spent a lot of time studying Scott's ears and were just looking for more strategies to be able to have him communicate with them as clearly as possible. And so I thought that was just a really, it's going to be a really fun journey to get to teach Scott a new system of communication with them to express what he's feeling.
Everybody think about that for a minute. What would happen? The people that have dogs that have dog tails are like, yeah. What would happen? Or the Schipperke owners are like, hey, my dog doesn't even have a tail. The Frenchie owners, the Boston owners.
Yeah, yeah.
What would it be like if you couldn't tell what your dog was feeling or how to read, you know, that was missing from the body language, that was missing from the overall, would you be able to tell what was going on? I use the tail so much. So I always like dogs that have their tail because I think it's just such an emotive part of who they are. And I know that that's, you know, a separate topic, but you know, if it's not there or it doesn't work because of whatever reason, you have to learn to compensate in other areas and pay attention to other areas a little more closely.
In this particular case where Scott needs a little scrub, a little wash up, you know, frequently.
A little scrub.
Due to his potty routines, and that's not a very pleasant experience for him. And it's a rather involved process for John and Julia. And really, again, they're sort of their ask or their concern or what they really came to us to address is, you know, there are moments where they feel like he's not okay emotionally with what's going on. And they want to do what they can to change that or to start to change that. And bath routine is something that, you know, honestly, they have got that down to a system, to a science. And we're going to look at a couple of areas to maybe do some desensitization or counter conditioning. But overall, they have that really, really down. And where we're going to spend some time is on the other kind of more cooperative care activities that we can create a separate routine where Scott gets to kind of opt in. Because one thing that we identified, you know, a huge form of communication in cooperative care training is the opt out, is a dog being allowed to stand up and walk away as a part of the process, right? So we can certainly do some activities with Scott in his wheels because our boy likes to move when he is in his wheels. But I don't know that he would necessarily want to be still long enough for a cooperative care routine when he's, you know, scooted up like that. So I think that what we have, and I guess I'm getting a little bit ahead, but what we've talked about doing in a way of creating communication channels for Scott is having that start button, having an opt in and not starting the process until he opts in. And because Scott is just so bright and loves to learn and loves to engage, he knows all kinds of cues around his face and his head, his little snoot and his little chin and his little boop and his little, you know, so I think we have lots of options to be able to work with there. And it's going to be, like I said, I think a fun journey to get to build these just new frameworks for communication for them that are really unique and specific.
If you can't say no and you can't move, that's pretty traumatizing for a lot of people for multiple reasons. It's traumatizing for a lot of animals for multiple reasons. None of them are good. You know, so we have to start talking about that this is a reality for our dogs. There are things they don't want to do, but they're terrified of doing them. And we're just like, must. You know, it's just, it's not that we just stop doing this stuff. Oh, your nails trimmed. Well, that seems a bit extreme. That's swinging a little too far. It's how can we learn?
Yeah.
How can we teach cooperation? How can we elicit cooperation with them so that there's not this disconnect, you know, between in going forward.
We're going to come back to the specifics of kind of creating these routines when we get into the modification plan and kind of how we plan to create and then preserve a cooperative routine while also simultaneously still getting his nails trimmed and still doing what we need to do for his day-to-day care, because, you know, it's not exactly something that, you know, you want to put off. And if there is a good system in place to get it done, there's no reason that has to stop. I think a really important consideration with cooperative care is that we use it for tasks where the answer can be no. And if the answer cannot be no, then you simply don't ask. That would be things like, you know, medical care.
Yeah, I'm working on that with a few of my clients right now. One of the dogs is scared of the car. Well, guess what? Sometimes we got to get in the car and go somewhere. So don't go through the procedure that we're doing for cooperative care. We don't go through all those steps and then put the and then put their dog in the car, because that's big time lying. You just don't ask and you just go.
It's a completely different process. Yeah. Yep. Yep. It's really like management at that point. Yeah. There were a couple of other things that seemed to really stress Scott out. Scott is a very sound sensitive dude, which when we were unpacking their plan with them, we got pretty into, you know, that likely came from his other limitations and the fact that he took in so much of his information through observation, because he wasn't physically interacting with the world in the same way as another dog would. And so his hearing is potentially, and I think that his behaviors kind of show that that's a, you know, high possibility, that he has even stronger hearing than an average dog. And because of that, things like fireworks and gunshots are absolutely terrifying. And he has a particular fear of things being cut on the cutting board, which has, again, with these bright, smart dogs and their pattern recognition, he's now figured out, well, that drawer has the knife. And when they reach for the chopping board after that drawer, like, that's all it takes for him to absolutely lose his mind. He knows the drawer in the refrigerator where the peppers come out of versus the cheese. The cheese drawer is safe. The pepper drawer is not safe. And he absolutely panics. And that's something that they just really didn't want to see and want to find a way to create something a little bit smoother for him and not have to feel like they are shutting him off in another room and just hiding him away from things, but actually stepping into something a little bit different, a little bit more sustainable. But let's look at some of the goals that they had for Scott, you know, in their own words, the things that they really wanted to do. And the number one thing was to really, again, understand his body language and just know what he wants and needs and be able to have him communicate that, because they're listening, you know, they're, what do you want? What do you need? What can we do for you? And they want to just be able to get a little bit more response back that they can understand, at least. They had a little bit of a
understand their dog's body language and get to know what they want and need.
I think many of the people that I work with definitely come in wanting to understand their dog better. But this is a particular case where John and Julia were just feeling limited by, you know, the lack of information that they felt like they were getting from half of this body.
I agree.
Another, we're going to call short-term goal, because it's something that we really wanted to tackle first before we moved on to some other things, is his food motivation seemed a little bit finicky. So we have been and will continue to dig into that and see. We've talked through diet switches. We've talked through maybe using an appetite stimulant. We've talked through a couple other possibilities. So we're going to continue to work through a solution there. And the reason that is such a, you know, key first step is because two of their other goals are to solidify recall, because specifically when Scott got his first set of wheels, he just gone the middle of the road. And so it's something that they just he tasted freedom and he was going to just see where the road could take him. And they were like, what?
No. He was like, what did you give them to me for then?
If not for this, for what?
Yeah. And he's like, oh, I thought I was supposed to be moving around.
And they want him to have so much freedom. So they really want a way to be able to bank the reps needed to have a strong, classically conditioned recall. Like, that's an understandable priority for when he's on his wheels, because having a long line attached to that, not entirely practical.
No.
Probably actually pretty treacherous.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be cool to see somebody build some sort of thing that came up and that like a drag line that came behind.
Yeah.
Saying if anybody's out there that wants to engineer and patent something like that for dogs like
the
Scott's.
Extendo.
The Extendo.
The Go-Go Gadget.
The Go-Go Dragline. Gadget Extendo. That would be so cute. Scott would be the first one.
Let us know. We'll market for you. And another goal that they had was around crate comfort. And this was for a very specific reason. And I think that this is really important to talk about because I kind of went through a very similar thing with my dog. And I know that we're not alone in that. And the reason they wanted Scott to be comfortable in the crate was not because he's crated in their house. He's not in the kennel. He doesn't need to be. My dog isn't either. There's no instance, no reason for him to be in the kennel. But there are other instances in his life where he has to be in a kennel. Our particular one was we were conditioning a car kennel for travel, and we needed him to be comfortable for potentially long car rides and long periods of time in that kennel. Now, for Scott, it's more specific to when he boards, because he boards at a vet facility. Because of his specific routines, he needs people who are more equipped to care for him. And he's going to be kenneled during that process. And they just know that that's not something that's entirely comfortable for him, because it's not something that's normal for him. And they have a desire to have some continuity for when they aren't there to make that an easier process for him. So we are looking into the specifics of where he's actually boarded and looking at the style of kennel that they use and, you know, really trying to create as much similarities as we can. And then we're going to be doing some conditioning, and just over time, because there's no urgent rush here, we're just going to be helping him feel a little bit differently about the kennel.
I'm going to tell you guys right now that if you choose not to use a kennel, that's totally up to you. Totally fine. I don't have one in my house even right now. But my dog knows how to use a kennel because I'm terrified that something's going to happen to him. And it has. Something's going to happen to him. And he's going to have to go to the hospital. And it would be the first time that he had to use a kennel, or he didn't know what was going on, and that he would think that he was injured and trapped in some prison, and had no idea what that was and why those people were putting him in that box. It's too much for me. I can't. Yeah. So I remember when he had his foreign body surgery, the techs were like, he just always goes right into his kennel. He's so good. He's quiet during the day. And then that way his body can heal. And he's not like that the entire time he's in the hospital, because he's not crate trained. So just consider it. And we have a free crate course on that.
Yeah.
If your dog is not crate trained, Madison wrote that course. Steph, shout out. Madison.
Teamed up with two other trainers. And it is very comprehensive, no matter how old your dog is.
And I'll tell you that every single one of my clients takes that course. And I don't even remember the last time I had to really even help them with crate training. They're just like, oh, look at this. It's working. I'm like, you don't say. I can't say enough good things about that course.
And, you know, this is actually my reminder for myself to pull out a wire kennel and practice with Remy, because he actually is getting a dental procedure next month. And I want him to not wake up from his anesthesia, you know, very, very drowsy and be in such an unknown situation. I want that to be very comfortable for him. I ask you like a just totally off topic vet tech question. If I were to send my dog in for a procedure with a blanket, is that appropriate to have something put in within his kennel that's familiar? Or is that potentially dangerous to introduce germs?
So, no, I wouldn't worry about the germs, because it's only going to go in post-op. So
right. Okay.
They will bring that to you. You'll bring it and then just say, hey, when my dog's in recovery, can you use this blanket, or can you put this blanket in there? Great, they have a nurse with them all the time, because they have to be extubated. Okay. And they have to have their vitals, you know, monitored and things like that before they go back in a kennel that will be their recovery kennel. So that's where that blanket would be. So no, as long as they are in the practice of putting little beds in there, which they should be for comfort.
It's a fear-free practice. I'm super happy with this vet clinic.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Then yeah, you just ask if your dog can have that post-op. And they'll be like, oh, sure, and they'll board, and you just make sure that you ask for it when you come back to pick up Remy.
Okay, perfect. That was really good advice. Thank you. You know, I don't want to be like a dog mom, but I want him to have something 100%. Comfortable and familiar.
I already know. Would they come in and I'm like, nope, we're not, you know, no, I'm that dog mom.
Excellent. Well, now I can confidently be that dog mom.
You can. And you can, you know, you can always set boundaries and be kind. You know, you can always, when I set a firm boundary, I thank people in advance for respecting it and for upholding that for me. And then we don't generally have to talk about it much after that. You know, people want to be a part of something. They don't want to be told what to do and bossed around, but they want to help.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at some of the longer term goals, and I guess only longer term because this is something that we have to work on some of these other things first and get the food motivation and learn to communicate with him and things like that, but really helping him manage those overall fears and not just loud sounds, right? Also medium sounds. He's definitely a sensitive boy, and building up his confidence. And I don't know that we used this phrase with them, but it's something that's been very top of mind for me with some of my clients. But I think building the resilience as well, the response to that stress, the response to that fear and the recovery, that's something I actually, when I was very into running for a short period of time, when you're looking to improve your overall speed for an upcoming race, you don't just bump up the speed of your whole run. You do sprints. And what you're actually focused on is the recovery time in between those sprints. It's not about how fast are those sprints. It's how fast can you get your breath back in between them and then do another one. And I think that that's something I use with my clients with reactive behavior is, okay, well, first we need to learn how to recover and how to regulate. And then we can talk about actually shrinking that bubble.
That's such a great analogy for people that are like, I just don't get why this is happening. Well, that's because your dog is trigger stacking and has no time to recover in between. Each individual thing in a cell, it's like of a deal. But when you put a whole bunch of sprints back to back, when you put a whole bunch of triggers back to back, you have to be able to recover between them. And as you practice more and more, just like Madison's saying, that recovery time becomes faster. And then you can handle longer distance faster, more triggers over a shorter period of time.
Yeah. You know, I have a client right now who is actually trigger stacking both good and bad emotions in a single walk. Think about that too.
That is so descriptive of my own personality.
I mean, sometimes they all get thrown in the same pot, right? And they all just get mixed up. And it's like, I don't know what I'm feeling, but I'm up here. I'm at a 9. And, you know, in his case, it's specific to excitement, maybe to see people. And then prey drive, seeing a bunch of deer. But then he sees a big dog, which is scary. So now he's got a fear response. And it's all stacking together because it's all nervous system dysregulation.
And I think those dogs are generally dogs that are candidates for medication. I'm just going to throw that out there. I'm not saying it as a blanket term. I think each case is individual. But when you have a dog that's feelings are so layered and complicated like that, and they literally cannot, I mean, what are you going to do? Stop the world? Never take them outside? Nothing? I mean, it's just, that's a different
thing. For me, this is where I actually look at that recovery time for the good feelings. If that is where I look first, they cannot recover from the good emotions in an isolated event. If they're that dysregulated, then we don't even have somewhere to start. And that's when I normally take a step back and say, we probably need to, you know, bring somebody else into this conversation because I don't think that we're at a, you know, a baseline where we can really learn.
Yeah, it happens. It doesn't happen often to me, but it happens. I normally have
one.
Doesn't
happen often. Normally, once we start to work on that like recovery rate and that regulation, normally once we start to work on that in the absence of the stress and we learn the skills, we're able to translate it. But when you can't even learn the skills in a, you know, happy, exciting, positive environment that is not stressful, that's when we look at potential medication intervention. The last thing on their list was the separation anxiety. And this is something that really what stood out to them, and this goes back to something that we were just talking about and we've talked about before when we have really, really smart dogs, is their ability to pick up on this pattern recognition. Is Scott has he is just so many steps ahead of them in terms of knowing when they are thinking about getting ready to leave. He has figured out the trigger before the trigger before the trigger to know what is the first step of their getting ready to leave the house routine. And that now has stress of its own. That's what happens with these, what we call pre-departure cues in the world of separation anxiety, is that they take on stress of their own. This is through the exact same power that we can create the positive association of our marker words. Our marker words, if it's followed by a payment, so many times, that marker becomes a secondary reinforcer, becomes a positive emotion for our dog. Well, when they see you grab your keys, that could do the same thing in a negative way because it's been paired with you leaving so many times that it holds its own stress. Really talking them through what it looks like to pull apart those pre-departure cues and trying to get a couple steps ahead and helping him feel a little bit differently about those triggers before the triggers.
I have to jump in and say something bitchy. I don't really think it's bitchy. I just think that it's definitely intense. I want people to listen to what I'm saying and really, really take it in. A lot of people, and this has nothing to do with anything Julie or John have done or said, but I see it in Scott, and so I want to use him as an example. People will say, it will have this issue with their dog, with what Madison just described, these pre-departure cues, and they'll say things like this, oh my God, my dog is just so smart. Okay, well, yes. Your dog is really great at pattern recognition, reading your body language and being in tune with that. That's what's happening. When we say it like that, an accountability that has to happen there, because we're just saying the thing, you know, that our dog is good at, but we're recognizing what they're good at. When we say something like, oh, they're just so smart, I don't know, they pick up on everything, and throw our hands up in the air, it makes it, now it's the dog's problem for being too damn smart. You know, and there's nothing I can do, and they're just going to catch on. That's not true. What's generally happening is the dogs, if you want to quantify the intelligence, the place that it is in pattern recognition. And so that takes us stepping in and, again, referring back to what you said, Madison, is breaking down those pre-departure cues and working on each step. But we have to do something. We can't just be like, oh, my dog's just really smart. And then that's the end of it. So, of course, Julie and John were not doing that. They recognized that his intelligence is in many areas, and that's one of them.
In looking at their plan, there was pretty much no changes needed to their management. They had everything really well in place, and there weren't any situations that were unmanageable. We did break things down into stages for them. So again, really having this ongoing stage of learning to read Scott a little bit better and creating some new channels of communication, starting with building his food motivation and working through some of the desensitization with the sounds, moving on to some cooperative care and grooming and solidifying the recall, and then finally moving on to some of the separation anxiety and the crate comfort and specifically those pre-departure cues. Modification plan that was a little bit more complex. Or the crate comfort, and we haven't started this process yet, but once we get the information about maybe what type of kennel he's kept in the vet clinic, being able to replicate that as best we can, I think we will have to get a little bit creative about how are we having that opt out and opt in for something like this. How are we creating patterns that allow for cooperative engagement? So I think there will be more to come on that. A lot of what we talked about with Scott was, we are going to build channels of communication. We are going to increase his food drive. We're going to do some counter conditioning and desensitization to things that stress him out. And then we're going to build some really unique patterns for him to be able to opt into things that are going to be a part of his everyday life. And they just want him to feel better about. For me, that's what his plan kind of boils down to for where we're working right now. Knowing that the separation anxiety is not something that is actually impacting them all that often, but they do want to have that kind of on the horizon as something that we'd like to continue to work towards. But really starting with like the everyday stress and de-stressing those moments that are unavoidable, and they just don't want to have to just hide him away from them. Something like folding laundry and, you know, kind of whipping a piece of clothing to be able to fold it. Yeah, that's a really stressful night for him. And we actually talked about specifically with sound triggers like that, where there's one volume with which we whip, right? Like if you were to just sort of lightly whip it, it wouldn't really make the noise. And how can we do desensitization to something that is like a one volume thing? And what we discussed was taking a sound recording or going to YouTube and actually finding a clip and then taking it down to volume one. And now we have
a baby. You know this. Lightly whip it. That's a very good point because it produces different sounds, the air comes out of the shirt different. all those little tiny things matter to dogs that we don't think about them because we have all these other things we're thinking about. They're thinking about what's going on in the room that they're in right then. So lightly whip it. That's the lesson for today.
Whip it real good.
Whip it real good. But only after proper desensitization.
Correct. Now, for recall, we just sent them to your recall course, which is honestly what I do with most of my clients at this point anyway. And I made a point to talk about this on my stories because somebody asked me what my least favorite thing to teach to owners is. And I said recall because it's that important to me. My dog is going to live his life on a drag line. He has all the freedom in the world with that leash dragging behind him. And I feel better and it's safer for us. And for most of the clients that I work with, recall is not really a part of the overall goal. Most of us were working through some, you know, pretty difficult behaviors and trying to create a more harmonious life together. And if recall is part of it, then you have a fantastic resource for that. And I should send them there. And then we can focus our time on true behavior change and emotional change, because recall is just about getting in your reps, classic conditioning. Right?
That's right.
Having that just like, beautifully just secure cue that will bring your dog back to you no matter what. And it takes discipline to get in the reps, and it's a use it or lose it. You stop practicing it, it stops working. That's just what it is.
Yep.
And I think that most, and I know you do. So I send them right to you because it's not important to me.
And it's the same with the crate. I hate teaching the crate. I hate it. So I have a crate course that I can refer people to. You have a, if it's something that you are doing over and over and over and over and over just as a dog trainer, make a course for it. Put your effort into it. Make that as a resource for each and every client that comes across your path so that they all have access to the same thing. And then they get that individual, unique experience working one-on-one with you.
That's what we mean when we say get creative with your delivery system, because Barry and I both think that dog trainer's time is really valuable and shouldn't be spent hours a day driving around.
It should be spent in the community.
And studying and, working and doing the things that...
Sometimes crying, you know? Sometimes
I'm crying. Definitely crying. Sometimes with our clients, sometimes on our
That's
own.
That's right.
Sometimes together,
Sometimes when you see dogs like Scott, oh, he's a gem. A real gem.
He really is. And I'm looking forward to getting into the cooperative care with them because we very specifically are working up towards some nail grinding. We already have fluency in several cues that we can choose from for a start button. And he seems to really like resting his little face in a hand. He's like, here, hold this. So I think we're going to have a really good time building up. You know, there's a lot of maybe not a lot of debate, but there is debate around the word consent versus, you know, cooperation. And I think what is important in this type of routine and the reason that the word consent probably does ring true for a lot of people, even if that isn't the case for everyone, is because it's creating a system of like informed consent, which is more of a legal term. And so I understand that doesn't really totally apply to dogs. But the idea is that you're going so slowly and you're showing them at each step what you're about to do and giving them the chance to say no and teaching them how to do that. That involves, even before they say no, saying no for them and creating an opt-out and reinforcing that. And it seems so counterintuitive, but that's an important first step. And that's why I think cooperative care and creating these informed consent routines is really important in this type of training and in allowing dogs to feel differently about routines that are part of their everyday life.
Cooperative care is not just for dogs. It's for multiple species. And I've been really working on that with old drop dead Fred, the billy goat. Some of you know I have. And
what have you been doing with him? I don't know about this.
Everything that I do with Fred is all he has to. It's just clip structure, pattern, and he has to opt into it. Otherwise.
I thought you meant you were doing like a new grooming routine. Like, were you like clipping his hooves or filing his little head?
Layla does all the grooming and she does not do cooperative care with him. I would say that she, well, no, maybe it's cooperative, but it's not informed consent. he cooperates for the snacks.
Goats don't learn the same way as dogs.
They don't. And the bigger and more unruly species is bigger and or more unruly, you really can't just force them to do things or make them do things. You know, especially with JB, my horse, well, my daughter's horse, excuse me, you know, the horse that I pay for, the horse that I pay for to go clean his poop. And he's great and I love it, but it's cool because you can start to see how there's a difference between making something do something and getting, you know, a 1,000-pound animal to cooperate with you out of choice. It feels different. And so I'm applying as much as I can to dogs.
I was inspired originally to really go down the cooperative care rabbit hole because you and I don't ever like dip our toe into anything. It's like, oh, here
it is. It's full on. It's full on Alice yes. down the rabbit hole.
Way down. So for me, it was, and I don't remember the zoo, but it was a zoo and it was a tiger. And they had taught the tiger who needed to get regular blood draws to give them his paw for blood draws or snackies. And it honestly rocked my world. I was like, but we can do this with dogs. And it just changed everything for me.
Yeah. Enzo will stand there and let you draw blood out of his jugular vein.
He's donated blood, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Multiple times for multiple dogs that needed blood transfusions.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
And so I had
to teach him. That's something that I don't think there's a lot of awareness about.
Yeah, your dog, if you have a big dog, your dog could be a donor. Normally, it's somebody within the hospital. There's, you know, everybody, it's just easier that way. You have a CLE. But fun fact, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it was awesome going through this plan, and I'm really looking forward to building these really, like I said, just unique patterns for Scott and getting to partner more with Julia and John to help them just understand their bud better.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm just hopeful that everyone that listens can take this as an inspirational episode, that it doesn't matter what your dog's limitations are. They still deserve and can, you know, through you, have access to a really great quality of life that's just right for them.
Absolutely.
Unpacked was created by Jerry Sheriff and Madison Simpson, edited and produced by Josh Wasta under the supervision of Straight Up Dog Talk LLC and Emily Breslin.
If you are enjoying this podcast, follow or subscribe to be sure you don't miss an episode and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Looking for more honest and relatable dog content? Check out our sister podcast, Straight Up Dog Talk. See you next time.